Lynn Rosetto Kesper with the Splendid Table. Today we learn about liquid gold. It's olive oil. So how does an awful tasting fruit become a liquid that can sell for up to $70 a quart? Our guest, olive oil expert Peggy Knickerbocker, has that answer and a lot more. Now, Jane and Michael Stern have found a great old-time cafeteria in Seattle. Our cheese expert, Steve Jenkins, explains how we can age our own cheeses. John Willoughby has an easy and luscious recipe for pickles. And we learn the secrets to exploring East Indian grocery stores. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rosetto Kesper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. This past weekend, I made a batch of ginger snaps. I wanted to try a new recipe from a book that came out recently. It occurred to me how easy it is to personalize most cookie recipes with your own flavorings. Here's what I mean. This ginger snap recipe was going for real spicy ginger flavor. So it called for the usual ground ginger plus grated fresh ginger root. I knew that some black pepper and not too hot chili powder would heighten that spiciness even more. Extra vanilla would give it just the right mellow balance to keep those flavorings from going over the top. So I have some suggestions for how to improvise with basic cookie recipes. I'm talking about sugar cookies, any kind of chocolate chip, spice, or oatmeal cookie. Now, the first rule to remember is that more vanilla is usually a good thing. Vanilla equals mellow and rich. Just be sure to use real vanilla extract, not the imitation kind. That can leave a nasty aftertaste. Where most cookie recipes call for a teaspoon of vanilla, using 2 teaspoons improves the cookie. The other rule with vanilla is wherever there's lots of spices in a recipe, like ginger snaps or oatmeal cookies, 2 teaspoons of vanilla mellows and blends flavors. It makes the cookie taste a bit richer. That goes for anything with chocolate. Vanilla is the natural complement to chocolate. This is a perfect marriage. Now, speaking of chocolate, you can add chocolate chunks or chips to any recipe you'd like. The same goes for nuts or dried fruits. Just fold them in as the last step in making the dough, or press pieces into the cookies once they're on the cookie sheet. Now, if your baking consists of buying cookie dough in tubes and slicing it onto a baking sheet, you can still improvise with this idea of pressing ingredients into the cookies. Oatmeal cookies taste especially good with little bits of dried apricot or dried cherries instead of raisins. Try salted peanuts pressed into chocolate chip cookies. Speaking of peanuts, in scratch cookies, you could take a basic sugar cookie recipe and turn it into a great-tasting, crunchy peanut butter cookie. Cut back slightly on the butter and blend it with chunky peanut butter. Let's say the recipe calls for a stick of butter. Well, use 3/4 of a stick and add 1/2 cup of peanut butter. Now, here's where extra vanilla really shines. Also, stir in some whole salted peanuts into the dough as the last step when you're mixing everything together. Now, speaking of salt, be sure there's enough in your cookie recipe. Salt, used judiciously, makes cookies taste sweeter, and it brings out all kinds of flavors. I usually figure if the recipe calls for 2 cups of flour, I'll add a slightly rounded 1/4 teaspoon of salt. Let's go back to that basic sugar cookie. Usually the recipe begins with beating together butter and sugar. Well, you can make orange coconut cookies by beating into the butter some generous amounts of shredded orange zest. Add some orange juice to the dough, and then as that last step, fold in a lot of sweetened coconut. And if you want to really take this over the top, along with the coconut, fold in pieces of high-quality white chocolate. Some of the lightest cookies you can make are meringues, egg whites beaten with sugar until they form soft peaks. Now, sometimes some acid like lemon juice is added. Then the fluffy mixture is dropped on a cookie sheet and baked. Now, most basic cookbooks have a recipe for meringues. Well, when you make the meringues, sift some cocoa into the whites once they're thick and beat in vanilla. Then, before dropping them on the baking sheet, fold in chocolate chips. Then bake as directed in the recipe. So, improvise with some basic cookie recipes and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, featuring Henkel's top-of-the-line, fully-forged professional cutlery. Henkel's is the knife choice of many professional chefs. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, today we're going to demystify olive oil. We talk with Peggy Knickerbocker. Peggy's the author of Olive Oil from Tree to Table. She's traveled all over the Mediterranean and California studying how olive oil is made and what makes for a quality oil. So she's bringing us an olive oil guide, everything from how it's made to tips for buying and tasting olive oil, like understanding what a label can reveal. Did you know product of Italy on a label doesn't necessarily mean that the oil in the bottle is Italian? Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins explains the art of the affineur. In France, that's an expert at ripening cheeses. And Steve has some ripening tricks we can use at home to improve our own cheeses. Food writer John Willoughby is coming by with a recipe for icebox pickles that he says is incredibly easy. Visiting an ethnic food market can be like taking a mini vacation. For an hour or so, you're in another world. Today, we learn how to explore an East Indian grocery with Linda Bladholm. She's obsessed with ethnic food shops, and she's doing a series of guidebooks on them. Then, as always, in the second half of the show, we open the lines for your calls. The number's 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are waiting in the wings. They're ready to get the show rolling. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, you know, Seattle has a lot of wonderful new restaurants to eat in. One of our favorite places to eat is very old and very square. It's a cafeteria called Bakeman's, a semi-subterranean restaurant that has what have to be the very best turkey sandwiches I have ever eaten.
You know, Lynn, a long time ago, Michael and I were talking to a turkey farmer, and we asked him, how did you know if the turkey was happy? And he said, they say, yettle, yettle, yettle. Well, when Michael and I go to Bakeman's and eat turkey sandwiches, we go yettle, 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 because this is not that dreaded turkey loaf that I think you know what I'm referring to, that sort of prefab reconstituted turkey that tastes like blubber. Mm-hmm. This is a real Thanksgiving-style bird that comes out of the oven at Bakeman's and is sliced fresh off the bone and just put on very simple sandwiches, and it's sublime.
Homemade white bread, maybe a little cranberry sauce if you want, a little mayonnaise, a little mustard. It's so simple, and yet it is turkey sandwich perfection. And turkey sandwiches, you know, can range from perfect to really bad, and this is at the top of the heap.
This sounds like real food.
It's great, and the bread is homemade. It's just a simple sandwich loaf, nothing fancy about it. It's homemade bread. If you don't like turkey, the other great thing to get at Bakeman's in the cafeteria line is a meatloaf sandwich. Like the turkey, it is homemade, it's fresh, it's moist. You get that on some of their whole wheat bread with little ketchup and shredded lettuce. One of those and a turkey sandwich is a double lunch that's delicious.
It it's a real blue-collar Seattle tradition. I mean, this is Seattle before there was Kurt Cobain and, you know, and grunge and, you know, Frasier on television. I mean, this is probably the old Seattle that goes back to, you know, the 1950s.
What does the place look like?
It's kind of half underground. You step down a few stairs to get into it. It's a really simple bare table, short cafeteria line. The line is quite long at lunchtime because this is no secret to Seattleites. But what's great about it is the line moves very fast. And in fact, if you're a little slow deciding whether you want mustard, you want mayonnaise, they will hurry you along behind the line because they cut that turkey. They make the sandwiches as fast as they can. The phrase that we always say when we get in line, or at least that I always say, is white on white M&M. That means white meat turkey on white bread with mustard and mayonnaise, and I'm a happy guy.
So white on white on M&M.
No, you added a word. You don't say on. You say white on white M&M.
Okay. So you do the meatloaf and you do the turkey. Is there anything else I should be looking for there?
They actually have, you know, some salads, and they have, you know, side dishes that are very uninteresting. They have terrific dessert. They have chocolate cake. They have a lemon poppy seed cake that's sliced and looks sort of like a slice of bread, but it's very sweet, not too sweet. It's got a real lemony flavor with the poppy seeds. It's a wonderful dessert. It's absolutely a totally rectangular meal if you get that for dessert.
This is kind of lunchbox cooking, if you know what I mean, or maybe I should even say lunch pail cooking because it's very 1940s.
Sounds like a seminar in starch as you describe this, you realize.
Yes, and what could be better than
And who
that?
Better to give the seminar than Jane and Michael Stern?
Hey, you two. Thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our own.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. You can hear them here every week on The Splendid Table, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins has spent the past 20 years hunting down exceptional cheeses. He's one of the pioneer advocates of artisan-produced raw milk cheeses, whether they come from Europe or America. And every time Steve visits, we learn something new. Hey, Steve, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Steve, what is affinage?
Affinage is a French word, which means the ripening process of the soft cheeses, be they goat, cow, or sheep. And one who practices affinage is referred to in France and Belgium as an affineur, A-F-F-I-N-E-U-R. So you're not just a cheesemonger like me, but you're also a ripener. So I'm a cheesemonger ripener, which in France is called a fromager affineur.
I see. And in Europe, there's a lot of these guys around, and women as well, you know.
Oh, yeah, and in each of the major cities of France, and even the not-so-major cities of France, there's at least one shop where the cheesemonger, the fromager, is considered a maître affineur, which means those soft cheeses that I find such joy in, my favorite cheeses, the Livoreaux and Camemberts and Pont l'Evêque of Normandy, the Reblochons of Savoie, the goat cheeses of the Loire Valley and the Rhone Valley and the Périgord region. These types of cheeses are turned out very, very young and soft and without character. The cheese maker is not going to hold on to those cheeses. He's going to ship them immediately to his négociant, his businessman in Rugis, the market south of Paris, who then sends them to the shops. And it happens very quickly. And when the shopkeeper, when the fromager gets those cheeses, it is his or her job to put them away at the right temperature and the right humidity so that they can be brought to ripeness, to the proper ripeness, which is referred to as being à point, P-O-I-N-T, to its best point. And we can't expect that to happen in America. We've got a few good cheesemongers, but frankly, just not that many. So I think it's important that our listeners understand how to be affineurs themselves.
All right, so what can we do?
Well, first I want you to make a fist, a loose fist, with your right hand or your left hand.
Uh-huh, okay.
And I want you to touch with your index finger that area between your thumb knuckle and your index knuckle. Feel that? It's kind of soft, sort of, sort of like a tush.
Right, okay.
That's how a Camembert or a Livarot or a Pont Levesque or a Reblochon should feel when it's just about ready to eat. Don't ball your fist up. Don't not like you're about to hit somebody.
Uh-huh.
But just like you've just drawn your fingers up into your fist and your thumb is hooked over, that area there between there is sort of soft.
Okay.
That's the way the cheese should feel. Now, with a goat cheese, though, it's entirely different. It's always been my pet peeve, Lynn, that people, oh, I love Chef. I love goat's milk cheeses. Well, frankly, most of them have never tasted a properly ripened French Chev. It means that, as I always say to you, young goat cheese is like eating overpriced cream cheese. It has no character. There's really nothing memorable about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for use in the kitchen for this, that, or the other thing. But on the table with a great funky knife and a great piece of wood and wonderful piece of bread and some kind of accompaniment, be it olives or be it fruit or whatever, that goat cheese has got to be ripened for 3 or 4 weeks. And I can't expect you guys to do that at home unless you know how or unless you have a great cheesemonger, affineur, who's going to do it for you.
All right, so but what should I feel for in a goat cheese?
You're not going to feel for anything. You're going to either buy that young goat cheese and take it out of the plastic wrap.
Mm-hmm.
If it's wrapped in plastic,
right.
Immediately take it out of the plastic wrap and shroud it in some tender wax paper, you know, like those Saver Wrap things that a baker uses to pick up a donut or a croissant.
Okay.
That stuff's easy to come by.
Uh-huh.
Then just loosely shroud that goat cheese in that stuff and put it in the bottom of the refrigerator or in the shelf in the refrigerator and let it sit there until the outside becomes sort of buff-colored and even mottled with blue mold and dry. Then it's coming ripe. And then when it's perfect as a matter of taste, you'll get used to it, and you'll find that as it gets more and more beige on the outside and drier on the outside, it's going to get nuttier, more nuancey. It'll get a little bit even sweeter than it was when it was very, very young. But that's the true glory of great goat cheeses, when that outside gets buff-colored and mottled with mold, and you're able to, and it's supple. It's not creamy soft. It becomes firm but yielding to a knife.
So we can become affineurs.
Absolutely. You're going to buy Camembert or Livarot or Pont Levesque or Reblochon in a store. If it's a good store, it does any movement, they're going to be too young. You're going to have to take them home and do the fist test to make sure that it's ready to eat. You also do the sniff test, and when it begins to smell like a good, clean barn, it's happening. If it begins to smell like a dirty barn, then by golly, you better eat the thing up or just get rid of it.
So I've got to clear out space in that fridge so there's
sure
plenty
do.
Of air circulation.
And every time you open that refrigerator door, plan on there being an effluvium wafting through your abode.
See, that's great. I can now say to my guests, quick, we must eat this Camembert. It's ready right now.
Yes, and tomorrow will be too late.
I love this. Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
Lunch and cheese and dinner and cheese. Fall and cheese and winter and cheese. Soup and cheese and jerky and cheese. Nuts and cheese and turkey and cheese. Cheese with pies and peppers and peas. Snow and beer and cheese.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. You can find Steve in New York City behind the cheese counter at Fairway Markets. Coming up, a guide to olive oils from the tree to the table, a fast and easy icebox pickle recipe, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. America is crazy for olive oil. It's been used in the Mediterranean for 3,000 years, but in America, the past 10 years have been amazing. Our attitude toward olive oil has changed radically. Whether it's because of health concerns or our love affair with Mediterranean foods, we're buying more olive oil now than at any time in our history. But buying is where the confusion comes in. There are a lot of oils out there, and you have prices ranging from $7 to $70 for a bottle. So what are the differences? How do you evaluate an oil? To help us understand olive oil, we've invited food authority Peggy Knickerbocker to join us. She's the author of Olive Oil from Tree to Table, and she's traveled all over the Mediterranean and California studying how olive oil is produced. Peggy, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be here.
Peggy, can you explain how an olive goes from being this fruit that if you bit into it right off the tree, you'd spit it out, it's so bitter. How does it become oil? Can you explain the process?
Well, I can. It probably started at least 2,000 years ago, the whole process. And what happens is the olives get picked, hopefully by hand, and then there's some urgency about getting them to the press quickly. They're rushed to a press, and then they are washed, and they are kind of crushed and mixed up by gigantic stones, kind of Flintstone-esque stones.
Mm-hmm.
And then it is, the mash is sort of spewed out onto mats, either made of hemp or nowadays more often made of nylon. And then those mats are stacked sort of the way records used to be stacked on a record player.
Uh-huh.
And then there's great exertion, pressure put upon them so that oil sort of drips out of the side. And then that oil is collected. That has all kinds of impurities. Not really impurities, but big hunks of olive and pit and that sort of thing. And then it, the water is separated, the olive water really is separated out from the oil through a system called a centrifuge. And then the oil is just goes into a spigot and sits usually for a day or so to kind of settle and gather itself together. And then it's put into bottles.
Now, why the urgency that once you pick it, you have to rush it to the mill?
Well, if you pick olives and you pile them one atop another,
mm-hmm.
the ones in the center, because they're living matter, really, will start to heat up and they can start to ferment. And the worst thing we want in an oil is to have fermentation, because that will give sort of a rancid off flavor. It will start the oil to a state of decomposition very, very quickly. So you want to get them before they have even a chance to change their composition whatsoever.
I see. Okay, now, what is extra virgin olive oil?
Well, extra virgin olive oil really is an oil that meets two criteria. In the Mediterranean, most of the countries circling the Mediterranean, almost all except I think Turkey, are under the auspices of a board that's called the International Council of Olive Oil that has its offices in Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
And there people are trained to be expert tasters of oil. So what happens is an oil is collected from, let's say, an estate someplace in Tuscany. That oil is rushed to Madrid and it is tested for its chemical makeup, and that test certifies that its acidity is less than 1%. And once it's met that chemical test, then it's set to a panel of tasters. And those tasters decide whether there are any defects in the oil. And if there are none, then it can be called an extra virgin olive oil.
Okay, now, is there anything on the label of an olive oil bottle that can tell us whether or not that oil has gone through that test?
It'll often say cold pressed. It'll often say estate bottled. It'll often say first press. And then what we really are hoping for is that there's a date on it, because olive oil, unlike wine, does not improve with age.
Okay, so what is just plain olive oil when I just see that on a label?
Well, just plain olive oil is perfectly good olive oil, and it's olive oil that did not perhaps meet the taste requirements, or perhaps it can be 1.5 acidity. And there's really nothing the matter with just plain olive oil. Sometimes it's called pure, sometimes it's just called olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of oil that's often really good to use if you're going to be frying something or if you're going to be roasting something in the oven over high heat. All the goodness of a really excellent, expensive oil just goes up in heat. So really, it's not bad to keep a little bit of the pure olive oil or regular, or just plain olive oil on hand for the heavy-duty workhorse kind of performances
yeah.
that we all have to do. But by and large, I use extra virgin olive oil for everything just because I'm an olive oil nut, and I just love the little teeny bit of flavor that leaches out when I'm frying or sautéing, and then I save my really good, expensive extra virgin oil for what they in the European community call anointing or baptizing the food. I know it's really gets kind of precious, doesn't it?
It may be precious, but boy, is it good.
Oh, I know.
What about this business? You said something in the book that really stopped me in my tracks. You said that if it says on an olive oil bottle label, produced in Italy or maybe produced in France, that doesn't necessarily mean that the oil in the bottle is from that country.
That's right, and this will probably be happening a lot more now that with the EU sort of opening the borders up. But as long as the final process, the final bottling or production occurs in a country, it can be called product of that country. But that is not the case of the small estate bottled oils. What you really want to do is, when you're buying your olive oil, you want to be buying it from a scrupulous dealer. You want to be able to say, hey, how long has this oil been on the shelf? When was this oil pressed?
Mm-hmm.
When did you get this bottle in? Because sometimes in big supermarkets, nobody knows, and they maybe bought a big pallet of oil from somebody on the cheap, and you don't want to buy oils from a big supermarket. You really want to buy them from a small wine dealer, a small delicatessen, or someone that really cares about the oil and knows about the oil, and that way you'll learn as you buy.
That's a great idea. Let's talk about California olive oil, because that's something we're really seeing more and more of in the market.
Well, really, we are in California, sort of where the wine industry was in the late 60s, early 70s. So it's new, you know. And there are some people that have revived ancient orchards, like the Shabikas down in the valley. And then there are other people that have, like Nan McAvoy and Ridgely Evers, who owns Davero Olive Oil Production. They have brought olive trees, bare root trees, in from Italy, and then they planted them in a similar soil and climate, and so we have really a wide, wide variety. And some of the ones I love are, as I said, Davero, and I love Nan McAvoy, McAvoy Ranch. I love the Shabika olive oil, which is available at our farmers markets all over the state.
Mm-hmm.
They're the oldest producers ever since 1936 that are commercial producers.
Uh-huh.
And Bonnie Storm is now available at Dean and DeLuca. They're kind of a new one on the market. And I love the Frantoio olive oil.
Well, now you've talked about how there are regulations on how oils are produced in Europe. Do we have any regulations here in the United States for American produced oils?
We're just starting. Since 1991, there is something called the California Olive Oil Council. And in the last 3 years, they have educated a panel of tasters who now can taste the oils once they're submitted, and if it meets the requirements that are the same as those set up by the International Council of Olive Oil, the acidity level and the taste approval, then a seal of approval is put on the bottle. So you want to look for that seal of approval, because it is really our only way of controlling flavor and consistency, really, in California olive oils.
Well, Peggy Knickerbocker, thank you.
Thank you.
Peggy Knickerbocker is author of Olive Oil from Tree to Table. You can get her recipe for tattooed potatoes with rosemary two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101, That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or you can go to our website at splendidtable.org. John Willoughby writes award-winning cookbooks and articles for national publications like the New York Times. You can always learn something from John, whether it's about cooking or just a bit of information that makes eating more fun. John, welcome.
Hey, Lynn. It's great to be back.
So what have you been up to?
Well, recently I've been making pickles.
Oh, that's all right. Now, to me, that's labor. I love pickles. I mean, I love homemade pickles, but to me, this is real work.
Well, I never used to make them because it's too much work for me, but these are quick pickles. They're pickles that are, they have all the flavor and the tang and the snap of traditional pickles that you used to put up, but they're refrigerator pickles and they're meant to be put in the refrigerator and eaten in about a month or less, which means you don't have to worry about botulism and you don't have to worry about canning, which is the big labor-intensive part of pickles. So you get all the flavor and all the fun, but you don't get any of the fuss or any of the fear. So,
oh, well, okay. This sounds like I can handle this. What do you do with this?
Yeah, I think you could, Lynn.
No, but how do you do this?
Well, what you're looking for is to get the flavor, and as I said, the kind of sweet tart flavor, and also that snap of traditional pickles. So what you have to do is have the right combination of acid, mm-hmm. which was used, you know, originally to preserve the pickles, but which gives it that nice sweet tart flavor, and salt. And you just put these pickles or vegetables or fruit or whatever you're going to be pickling in salt for about 2 hours, or with some of them up to 24 hours, and what that does is draw out some of the moisture so that when you immerse the fruit or vegetable into the pickling liquid, it stays crisp.
Oh, that's
but it only
the
takes
trick.
just a little while, you know, then you rinse off the salt, you put them in a hot bath of, you know, usually it's got some kind of acid in it, some kind of vinegar or citric acid or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and you, in an hour and a half, they're ready to eat.
So you can make this acid bath, do you add sugar to it and spices?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's fun to experiment with different kinds of vinegar, and we also found that alcohol works very well. We have a really nice pickle with gin in it, or one with tequila, because, you know, for some reason there's an affinity between these alcohols and the vinegars, because vinegars come from alcohol, so we've turned out some that really taste great, and you can use any kind of spices you want. It's really easy. It's really delicious.
Do you actually cook it in this mixture, or do you just put it in?
No, a lot of traditional pickles are cooked in the mixture, but that was largely to make sure that no bacteria develops, so you don't really need to do that with these. And I found that, you know, I don't really pay close enough attention to do things that require split-second timing.
Yeah,
and if you leave them in the hot, if you cook them for too long, they get mushy. So I found that if you actually just heat up the solution and the brine and pour it over them, you don't have to worry about that.
So, John, give me an example. I mean, I've got some of these small pickling cucumbers from the farmer's market. How would you do this?
Well, I would take the cucumbers and cut them in half and cover them with salt. You know, if you've got a couple of pounds of cucumbers, you might want to use 3 or 4 tablespoons of salt and set them aside. With cucumbers, I like to leave them a little longer because they can be watery. So leave them, say, 12 to 24 hours. And after about 12 hours or so, you'll see that they're sitting in a little puddle of water. And that's the liquid that's been drawn out by the salt. So you take them and rinse off the salt, and then you set them aside. Then you take, a cup and a half or so of, let's say, red wine vinegar, maybe a half to three-quarters cup of sugar, and some coriander seeds that you toast and then crush up. You put all that stuff into a saucepan and bring it to a boil. Then you put the cucumbers into, I like to use glass jars because they're pretty, but you can use any kind of sealable container.
Mm-hmm.
And you pour the hot liquid over them, let it come to room temperature, cover it, put it in the refrigerator, and there you go.
Oh, okay.
That's it.
John, this is easy. Thank you.
It is easy. Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is co-author with Chris Slazinger of License to Grill. You can get John's pickle recipes by going to our website at splendidtable.org. Now, if you really want to get serious about this, we've a little tip from an award-winning pickle pro, Catherine Ernest. She's one of the Gedney Company's pickle people.
When I usually do a bunch of pickles, I probably put in about a half of a bushel at a time in the washing machine, and I use very cold water, gentle cycle, and the movement of the pickles in the water, in the cold water, helps to clean them and wash them and take off all the spines that are on them, because you're using a small dill pickle like that, it still has most of its spines on it. It hasn't rubbed enough of them away. So it really takes a little while to clean them, but the movement of the water cleans them very thoroughly. It doesn't remove the blossom end, however, so you have to clip that off later.
Those blossom ends, always a problem. Lines are now officially open. The number is 800-537-5252. Give us a call and we will talk. Anything goes. Let's get right to the phones. We have Lena calling. So, Lena, what do you want to talk about?
How are you doing today?
I am swell. What's on your mind, woman?
I'm so excited I get to ask you about this. I recently was in Toronto and had ricotta gnocchi. And they were absolutely fabulous. They were very light and just delicious. And of course I said to the waiter, oh, do you share your recipes? Could I get a recipe for this? And he kind of looked at me kind of like, I can't believe you're asking. But I've been out searching for a ricotta gnocchi recipe, and all that I find are recipes that have the ricotta and the spinach.
Yes.
With them.
Yes.
But can you suggest how I can try and experiment with just ricotta?
One of the names for this is a ravioli nudi.
Yes.
N-U-D-I. Ravioli.
Naked.
Yes, naked ravioli. Ravioli without the pasta.
Right.
Because it's very similar to a ravioli filling. And I must confess, because this is a specialty of Tuscany, and my mother's family is Tuscan. I was raised with Tuscan food. I have not made these probably in 30 years. This may not be the person to ask, but the basic idea behind them is you need something to bind, because if you just drop, you know, if you mix ricotta and egg and seasoning like salt and pepper and that kind of thing, and you drop it in water, it will fall apart.
Exactly.
Yeah. So some people use a little flour or they use a little potato. But I will tell you a source. Rather than mislead you with my misremembering, let me tell you one of the classic sources for this information. It is a food writer named Giuliano Bugiali.
Oh, yes.
Of course. And one of his great books, and he's done many fine books, but he did a book called The Fine Art of Italian Cooking.
Okay.
And this was his very first book. And it was about classic Tuscan cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And that recipe is a dynamite recipe that he has.
Well, that's interesting, because in all my Italian cookbooks and the internet, I never thought to look up ravioli nudi. I always kept looking for
gnocchi. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And you know, the thing that's so puzzling about Italian food is the same dish's name will change from place to place.
Oh, yes, even 10 miles down the road.
You've got it.
Thank you for your suggestion.
Okay, Lena, thanks for calling.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. It's time for our trivia question of the week. This is the part of the show where we try to challenge your knowledge of arcane, fascinating, or just plain useless bits of food lore. This week's question is, how many olives, by weight, does it take to make 1 cup of olive oil? We'll have that answer in a moment. We'll take a tour of an East Indian grocery store, and we'll get back to your calls. So get to the phones, guys. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. It's open lines for your calls this hour at 800-537-5252. But before going back to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, how many olives by weight does it take to make 1 cup of olive oil? It takes 13 pounds of olives. No wonder olive oil can get so expensive. Talk about it takes a village. Some of the oils I love are so expensive, you have to pass the hat around the village square to be able to dress a salad. You'd think it was pressed between the knees of virgins. Now, if you're as ridiculous as I am about olive oil, I've got a little comfort for you. For all that money, you do get something that has noble connections and is the oil of champions. Olive oil is the anointing oil of choice at the coronations of most kings and queens. How's that for a testimonial? And at the original Olympic Games in ancient Greece, winners were awarded with olive oil. Okay, just in case I've gotten some of you previously sane folks thinking about spending a fortune on olive oil, here's a tip list to help you get your money's worth. With premium oils, you want to be sure they're not more than a year old. That's when their flavor starts to fade. So look for a date of pressing. It's like a vintage date on a wine bottle. Look for produced and bottled by on the label. This means the oil was actually made by the people who were bottling it. And always try to taste before buying, because extra virgin is nowhere near the whole story. It's got to taste great, and all oils are not alike. Now, one of the best ways to taste without going broke is to convince friends to buy the oils you're interested in. Taste theirs, then decide if you want to spend your own money. But just to be sure they're still your friends, you'd better invite them to dinner and be generous with that olive oil. Okay, back to the phones. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up. We have Corey on the line. Corey, what's on your mind?
Well, I had a pesto disaster recently.
A pesto disaster?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, it was disgusting. I made a really nasty mess.
What did you do?
Well, I recently moved to a neighborhood in Minneapolis where there are all kinds of nice Asian markets. And in these Asian markets, you can find Thai basil in abundance and at little to no cost compared to what you pay in a grocery store. And I wanted to do something interesting with this. I wanted to make an Asian pesto.
Good idea, yeah.
This is what I figured, and anyone can do this fusion stuff, right? So I took a basic Genovese recipe and substituted out some of the basil and added in spinach, put in some cilantro for the parsley. I used roasted peanuts instead of pine nuts. And for the oil, I used a combination of sesame and light olive oil. And served it on soba noodles with some chicken grilled that had been marinated in satay, and put some peanuts and lemon wedges, and I thought it was going to be fantastic. And it ended up tasting like soap.
Corey, I have to tell you, that sounds terrible. But trust me, I know where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Because one of the ways you get to getting all these recipes you write, if you're a food writer, you know, into print that are good, is you do things like that first. And you end up with really lousy food, and then you learn a lot. So don't feel bad. You know, could you explain to people what Thai basil tastes like? Because a lot of people don't know.
It has a much more fragrant, pungent taste almost. It has a much more aggressive, it's not as sweet and I'm lacking adjectives today.
Mild-mannered, perhaps?
It's the kind you want to put 3 or 4 leaves in, like, your hot bowl of pho or whatever, and then that sort of seeps through it like an infusion, a tea.
It's almost spicy. I always think of that it has cinnamon and allspice in the basil.
Yeah.
Okay, so your deal here is you'd like to see if there's some sort of pesto-style sauce you could make with Asian ingredients.
Yeah.
Okay, I think where you went wrong there, I mean, aside from, I think it had too many things going on.
Uh-huh.
And as I said, that's a common trap. go with just the basil.
Okay.
Forget about the other green herbs. And the other thing is the Thai or Asian sesame oil, really you use by the drop. Because,
yeah,
boy, a lot of that can kill anything. This is what I would do. I would grind or pound or whatever together the Thai basil and a lot of garlic with some chilies.
Okay.
Let's go the whole route of what Asia does.
Okay.
And I'd make that almost into a paste. And then I would add a little bit of vegetable oil.
Okay.
And a little Thai or Vietnamese fish sauce for your salt.
Okay.
But like a teaspoon or two.
Okay.
And some water.
Uh-huh.
And a little brown sugar.
Okay.
And if you wanted to, after you toss it with the noodles, okay, you could sprinkle it with fresh lime juice.
I see.
And if you do that, I think you'll really get a lot of nice quality, good flavor going. It'll be very fresh.
And leave out the cilantro altogether.
I think so, because I think you've got too many complicated flavors going there.
Well, I should have known better. In Spanish, they say cilantro, pero no tanto. You don't put so much in or else it ends up running the dish. So.
Yeah, and you know, the place where you can get away with handfuls of cilantro is if you were making this into something that you would marinate a chicken in or that kind of thing.
Sure.
And there, by the way, you can throw the entire cilantro. I use the stems and everything.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's a whole other issue. But there's an attempt at sort of a pesto in the Asian style.
Okay.
Hey.
Excellent.
Hey, thanks. And thanks for introducing a lot of folks to Thai basil.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, enjoy the new neighborhood.
All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, Susan's on the line. Susan, what
yes,
do you
hi.
Feel like talking about at this very moment?
I've made some mead off of a recipe.
Yeah.
And the last part of the directions say, when fermentation has stopped, cork tightly and seal with paraffin.
Now, wait.
Okay.
Hold on a second, though. I think you're going to have to explain to all of us what you mean by mead.
It's an alcoholic beverage using honey as the sweetener.
Uh-huh. And what else?
And, well, mine has strawberries and pineapple and the white raisins.
Wow. This is a really old thing. I mean, I remember reading about mead and medieval recipes and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they say when the fermentation stops, seal it.
Yes.
And are you saying you maybe didn't have any fermentation?
I had bubbling, and I still do have some bubbling, but I corked them probably a couple weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
You're supposed to cork them lightly and then more tightly after fermentation has stopped.
Right.
But I couldn't tell. I don't know when to tell when it stopped.
Gosh, I've never done this, but what does it look like at this point?
Oh, it's a beautiful rose color.
Right.
And
is there anything funny on the top of it?
Yep, just a little bit of like white foamy stuff on the top of them.
It doesn't look like mold or anything, does it?
No, not mold.
Okay, all right. Because, I mean, basically what you've got is a sugar, combination of sugar, because the honey's sugar and the fruits you're using are sugar,
mm-hmm.
that should start to ferment into alcohol.
Right, because you have to put a thing of yeast on the top of it to begin the whole process.
Yeah, so that kind of kicks off the process. And have you left it open, or they just tell you to mix it all together and put that cork in lightly from the very beginning?
Oh, God, you had to boil everything, and then for 2 weeks you had to stir the whole mess for every day, and it was covered in cheesecloth and set in a warm spot, and then you had to strain it through the jelly bag, and then it had to settle for two more days, and then you did it in the sterilized bottles.
Susan, this is a great deal of work. Is this worth it? Woman, I think you may want to rethink this.
It wasn't that bad, though, because once you boiled it, I mean, it just sat on a pot on the counter, and I'd go and I'd stir it once a day and go and smell the stuff. The first couple of days, it smelled horrible, but then after that, you just smelled all the strawberries and everything.
Yeah, fermentation never smells good, does it?
You know,
does it?
No,
but
not
so
at all.
I would say once the foaming stops,
okay,
you're in pretty good shape.
Should I shake them or anything to see if they send up more bubbles or?
I'm not sure, but I know that the fermentation shows up as bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
I remember someone actually showing me a wine barrel, that was fermenting, and you could put your ear to it and hear it. I would say that if you're not getting bubbles, then it's okay. But I would also taste it at this point. It may be very drinkable. It also sounds like it should be quite delicious. I'm teasing you about why bother, but it does sound like it could be pretty good.
Yeah, the last thing it says, age at least 8 months, and it ends with, if you can hold out for a whole year, this mead tastes like bottled summer.
Oh, this sounds lovely.
And, I mean, that's what sold me on it.
I guess for bottled summer, I would too, but I have to wait 8 months?
Yeah.
Oh, no. All right. Okay. Be patient. But okay. I would say it sounds like they're having you sterilize and boil and do all the things you want to be cautious about.
Right.
I would say taste it now and see what it tastes like.
Okay.
If you get any sense of fizziness or whatever, let it go a little bit further.
Okay.
Okay?
Oh, great.
I wish I could tell you more, Susan, but it sounds great. You know what? After you've aged it, call us and tell us what it's like.
Oh, I will.
Dynamite. Susan, drink on.
Oh, thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Jennifer's on the line. So, Jennifer, what stirring question or item would you like to discuss today?
Hi, Lynn. Sushi bars are on my mind. My husband and I love sushi. And at a couple of the sushi bars we go to, we're greeted by the chefs with a salutation when we enter and when we leave.
Mm-hmm.
And not knowing Japanese, we've always wondered what they're saying and what the proper response would be.
Yeah, we have a local restaurant that every time we walk in, they call out a greeting. And then everyone in the kitchen, it's an open kitchen, everybody in the kitchen responds. And I asked this question, this was a couple of years ago, of our waitress, you know, what was happening. What is happening is we're being greeted with welcome to our establishment, or we hope you have a good time. It's a courtesy greeting. And evidently, the correct thing for us to do is to smile and nod or just say thank you.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay.
I'll make my way to the sushi bar tonight.
You got it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Indian food is influencing a lot of American chefs lately, and there's a bunch of new cookbooks on the subject. Now, visiting an ethnic grocery can be like taking a mini vacation. Linda Bladholm is the author of The Indian Grocery Store Demystified. She has a few tips for us to get started at an Indian grocery. Linda, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, too.
Linda, are there actually different regional cuisines in India?
Yes, there are. India is a huge country, as you probably know, and there's a vast difference between, let's say, the north and the south. The north, the food is richer, made with a lot of dairy products and cooked in ghee, and they use a lot of warming spices, but not necessarily spicy hot. Whereas the further south you go, the hotter and spicier the cuisine goes to match the temperature. And then on the east coast in Bengal, the cuisine is pungent and hot with a lot of mustard seeds and a lot of seafood and fish. Whereas on the west coast, like the Gujarat state, which is just above Bombay, they're mostly vegetarians there, so the emphasis is on dal and vegetables.
Well, one of the things I always associate with Indian food are the spices. And I'm thinking, if you could help us put together some very basic things to have in the pantry to get us started.
That's hard because, as you know, there are so many spices. But I would say if you could just pick four or five, the most used and most important ones would be coriander seed, cardamom, cumin, curry powder, and mustard seeds.
Now, the other thing I always associate with Indian food is basmati rice. How do you go about buying this?
Well, from my experience, I find that there's certain brands from Dehradun, that's the area where they grow rice in the Himalayan foothills. That's one of the best qualities that you can find. So look for Dehradun or Dehraduni, it sometimes says on the bag. And then I found the best rices, say, aged, because basmati should be aged. It's like wine. It actually improves in flavor. It can be aged up to 10 years or more. And the next thing to look for is try to buy it if there's a plastic liner inside. They usually come in jute or burlap bags.
Mm-hmm.
And I find sometimes the kind in burlap, if they don't have a plastic liner, have a kind of musty smell that remains in the rice even after you cook it.
Is the word aged actually on the package?
Some of them, it actually says aged. It won't say how many years, but sometimes it just says super Derriduni or super quality or something like that that indicates it's a cut above.
You know, I'm someone who loves the instant hit, and I know that Indian grocery stores have great bags of snacks. I love Indian snacks. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Oh, I love them, too. A lot of them are a really wonderful mix of contrasting flavors, and they're delicious.
Are there any names to look for of these things?
Well, sometimes they're called like Punjabi hot mix or things like chana chor, which are they're cooked chickpeas, which are flattened and then fried and seasoned with salt and sugar, and you just zap them in a microwave or a warm oven and sprinkle a little lemon juice over them. That really brings out the flavor.
What about prepared foods? Is there any kind of takeout that we might find in Indian groceries?
It depends on the store. Some actually have a takeout counter with not full meals, but you'll find samosas and these little deep-fried potato balls stuffed with peas. And sometimes you'll find warm naan bread with little kebabs of meat. And there's also a lot of, if you'd like to eat Indian curries, but you don't really want to fool around cooking them, you can buy canned, very good quality ones that you just open the can and heat it up. And there's also a lot of frozen possibilities, like masala dosa, which are like a thin fermented rice flour crepe stuffed with a masala mixture of potatoes. And you can also get frozen idli, which are these little, they look like little mini flying saucers. They're made out of the same kind of batter, but they're steamed little cakes, which are delicious with chutney or some kind of hot relish.
Sounds delicious. Linda, thank you.
You're welcome.
Linda Blatholm is author of The Indian Grocery Store Demystified. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thanks to everybody for joining us, and have a great week. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with an observation from character actress Billy Burke. Age is something that doesn't matter unless you are a cheese. Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Jennifer Russell and Sally Swift. Our associate producer is Jennifer Lubke. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.